Chapter 35. Objective, contemplative. He's going to marry her, murmured Reddy, never taking eyes off Tess.
Our face do show it.
You be going to marry him? Asked Marion.
Yes, said Tess.
When? Someday. They thought that this was evasiveness only.
Yes, going to marry him, a gentleman, repeated Is Hewitt.
And by a sort of fascination the three girls, one after another, crept out of their beds, and came and stood barefooted round Tess. Reddy put her hands upon Tess's shoulders, as if to realize her friend's corporeality after such a miracle, and the other two laid their arms round her waist, all looking into her face.
How it do seem.
Almost more than I can think of, said Is Hewitt. Marion kissed Tess.
Yes, she murmured as she withdrew her lips.
Was that because of love for her, or because other lips have touched there by now? Continued Is dryly to Marion.
I wasn't thinking of that, said Marion simply.
I was on feeling all the strangeness out, that she is to be his wife, and nobody else.
I don't say nay to it, nor either of us, because we did not think of it only loved him.
Still, nobody else is to marry in the world, no fine lady, nobody in silks and satins, but she who do live like we.
Are you sure you don't dislike me for it? Said Tess in a low voice.
They hung about her in their white nightgowns before replying, as if they considered their answer might lie in her look.
I don't know, murmured Reddy Priddle.
I want to hate thee, but I cannot.
Tee, that's how I feel, echoed Is and Marion.
Can't hate her. Somehow she hinders me.
He ought to marry one of you, murmured Tess.
Why?
You are all better than I.
We better than you? Said the girls in a low, slow whisper.
And no, no, dear Tess.
You are, she contradicted impetuously.
And suddenly tearing away from their clinging arms, she burst into a hysterical fit of tears, bowing herself on the chest of drawers and repeating incessantly,
oh yes, yes, yes.
Having once given way, she could not stop her weeping.
He ought to have had one of you, she cried.
Think I ought to make him even now.
You would be better for him than I don't know what I'm saying.
Oh, oh.
They went up to her and clasped her round, but still her sobs tore her.
Get some water, said Marion. He's upset by us. Poor thing, poor thing.
They gently led her back to the side of her bed, where they kissed her warmly.
You are best form, said Marion.
Or ladylike, and a better scholar than we, especially since he had taught thee so much.
But even you ought to be proud.
You be proud, I'm sure.
Yes, I am, she said.
And I am ashamed at so breaking down.
When they were all in bed, and the light was out, Marion whispered across to her,
you will think of us, when you be his wife, Tess, and of how we told thee that we loved him, and how we tried not to hate you, and did not hate you, and could not hate you, because you were his choice, and we never hoped to be chose by him.
They were not aware that, at these words, salt, stinging tears trickled down upon Tess's pillow anew, and how she resolved, with a bursting heart, to tell all her history to Angel Clare, despite her mother's command to let him for whom she lived and breathed despise her if he would, and her mother regard her as a fool, rather than preserve a silence which might be deemed a treachery to him, and which somehow seemed wrong to these.
XXXII, this penitential mood kept her from naming the wedding day. The beginning of November found its date still in abeyance, though he asked her at the most tempting times. But Tess's desire seemed to be for a perpetual betrothal in which everything should remain as it was then. The meads were changing now, but it was still warm enough in early afternoons, before milking to idle there a while, and the state of dairy work at this time of year allowed a spare hour for idling. Looking over the damp sod in the direction of the sun, a glistening ripple of gossamer webs was visible to their eyes under the luminary, like the track of moonlight on the sea. Gnats, knowing nothing of their brief glorification, wandered across the shimmer of this pathway, irradiated as if they bore fire within them, then passed out of its line, and were quite extinct.
In the presence of these things he would remind her that the date was still the question. Or he would ask her at night, when he accompanied her on some mission invented by Mrs. Crick, to give him the opportunity. This was mostly a journey to the farmhouse on the slopes above the vale, to inquire how the advanced cows were getting on in the straw barton to which they were relegated. For it was a time of the year that brought great changes to the world of kine. Batches of the animals were sent away daily to this lying-in hospital, where they lived on straw till their calves were born, after which event, and as soon as the calf could walk, mother and offspring were driven back to the dairy. In the interval which elapsed before the calves were sold there was, of course, little milking to be done, but as soon as the calf had been taken away the milkmaids would have to set to work as usual. Returning from one of these dark walks they reached a great gravel cliff immediately over the levels, where they stood still and listened. The water was now high in the streams, squirting through the weirs, and tinkling under culverts. The smallest gullies were all full, there was no taking shortcuts anywhere, and foot passengers were compelled to follow the permanent ways. From the whole extent of the invisible vale came a multitudinous intonation. It forced upon their fancy that a great city lay below them, and that the murmur was the vociferation of its populace. "It seems like tens of thousands of them," said Tess, "holding public meetings in their marketplaces, arguing, preaching, quarreling, sobbing, groaning, praying, and cursing." Claire was not particularly heeding. "Did Crick speak to you today, dear, about his not wanting much assistance during the winter months?" "No. The cows are going dry rapidly." "Yes. 6 of 7 went to the straw barton yesterday, and 3 the day before, making nearly 20 in the straw already. Odd it that the farmer don't want my help for the calving? Oh, I am not wanted here anymore. And I have tried so hard to." "Crick didn't exactly say that he would no longer require you. But, knowing what our relations were, he said in the most good-natured and respectful manner possible, that he supposed on my leaving at Christmas I should take you with me, and on my asking what he would do without you, he merely observed that, as a matter of fact, it was a time of year when he could do with a very little female help. I am afraid I was sinner enough to feel rather glad that he was in this way forcing your hand. I don't think you ought to have felt glad, Angel. Because 'tis always mournful not to be wanted, even if at the same time 'tis convenient." "Well, it is convenient you have admitted that." He put his finger upon her cheek. "H," he said. "What? I feel the red rising up at her having been caught. But why should I trifle so? We will not trifle, life is too serious." "It is. Perhaps I saw that before you did." "She was seeing it then. To decline to marry him after all in obedience to her emotion of last night and leave the dairy, meant to go to some strange place, not a dairy, for milkmaids were not in request now calving time was coming on, to go to some arable farm, where no divine being like Angel Claire was. She hated the thought, and she hated more the thought of going home. So that, seriously, dearest Tess," he continued, "since you will probably have to leave at Christmas, it is in every way desirable and convenient that I should carry you off then as my property. Besides, if you were not the most uncalculating girl in the world, you would know that we could not go on like this forever. I wish we could. That it would always be summer and autumn, and you always courting me, and always thinking as much of me as you have done through the past summertime. I always shall." "Oh, I know you will," she cried, with a sudden fervor of faith in him. "Jell, I will fix the day when I will become yours for always." Thus at last it was arranged between them, during that dark walk home, amid the myriads of liquid voices on the right and left. When they reached the dairy, Mr. and Mrs. Crick were promptly told with injunctions of secrecy, for each of the lovers was desirous that the marriage should be kept as private as possible. The dairyman, though he had thought of dismissing her soon, now made a great concern about losing her. What should he do about his skimming? Who would make the ornamental butter pats for the Angleberry and Sandburn ladies? Mrs. Crick congratulated Tess on the shilly-shallying having at last come to an end, and said that directly she set eyes on Tess she divined that she was to be the chosen one of somebody who was no common outdoor man. Tess had looked so superior as she walked across the barton on that afternoon of her arrival, that she was of a good family she could have sworn. In point of fact, Mrs. Crick did remember thinking that Tess was graceful and good-looking as she approached, but the superiority might have been a growth of the imagination aided by subsequent knowledge. Tess was now carried along upon the wings of the hours, without the sense of a will. The word had been given, the number of the day written down. Her naturally bright intelligence had begun to admit the fatalistic convictions common to field folk, and those who associate more extensively with natural phenomena than with their fellow creatures, and she accordingly drifted into that passive responsiveness to all things her lover suggested, characteristic of the frame of mind. But she wrote anew to her mother, ostensibly to notify the wedding day, really to again implore her advice. It was a gentleman who had chosen her, which perhaps her mother had not sufficiently considered. A postnuptial explanation, which might be accepted with a light heart by a rougher man, might not be received with the same feeling by him. But this communication brought no reply from Mrs. Durbeyfield. Despite Angel Clare's plausible representation to himself, and to Tess of the practical need for their immediate marriage, there was in truth an element of precipitancy in the step, as became apparent at a later date. He loved her dearly, though perhaps rather ideally and fancifully than with the impassioned thoroughness of her feeling for him. He had entertained no notion, when doomed as he had thought to an unintellectual bucolic life, that such charms as he beheld in this idyllic creature would be found behind the scenes. Unsophistication was a thing to talk of, but he had not known how it really struck one until he came here. Yet he was very far from seeing his future track clearly, and it might be a year or two before he would be able to consider himself fairly started in life. The secret lay in the tinge of recklessness imparted to his career and character by the sense that he had been made to miss his true destiny through the prejudices of his family. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.